like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, the government's own concessions in this case would require reversal of the Board's decision. The Board here held that, quote, a person's mental health is not a factor to be considered in particularly serious crime analysis, end quote. But the government concedes at page 42 of its brief that its common sense suggests that mental health has an impact on subjective intent. It also concedes, and case law clearly establishes, that intent is relevant to the particularly serious crime analysis. So, well, Your Honor, in matter of LS,
your crime can be dangerous or serious regardless of intent. I mean, you could say, crimes are dangerous, and whether done by accident or not done by accident shouldn't be a matter because you are why you have to protect the public. And why is the entirely reasonable?
Your Honor, the Board precedent and this Court's precedent both acknowledge that subjective intent is relevant. In matter of LS, which is an en banc decision of the Board, the individual was convicted of alien smuggling. He had put a person inside a small compartment underneath his van to smuggle her over the border. It's an inherently dangerous crime, and the Board so held. It put the woman at risk, it put American lives potentially at risk. And the Board said it is dangerous, to your point, Your Honor. It is dangerous, but that's not the question. The question is it so dangerous to justify the presumption that he should not be protected from persecution or torture? That's the precise question. And the Board found, no, it was not, in fact, extremely relevant, the fact that he did not intend to harm her. Similarly, in Alphonsus v. Holder, this Court looked at a man convicted of a crime of resisting arrest of an executive officer. The elements of that include resisting through force or knowingly resisting through force or violence an executive officer. Again, an inherently dangerous crime, to use the wording of the Board. And the Court remanded the case because it did not understand the Board's rationale but found it extremely relevant that there was no record of his intent to actually harm the officer. So the precedents indicate that intent to harm is a piece of the puzzle because the court must, the immigration judge must look at all relevant evidence, all reliable evidence, including the underlying circumstances of the crime. If that's the case, then Mr. Gomez-Sanchez should have a right to present all reliable evidence regarding his mental health in order to
assist him. Everybody gets to prove that everyone who commits one of these crimes gets to prove subjective intent to committing the crime. Some gets to retry the case.
So this does not require retrying the case, not particularly in this case, Your Honor. This crime.
Mental insanity or lack of competence is a. It's part of the definition of crime, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And so
because there is an insanity defense, which was raised in the crime of one issue that affects the retrying the case.
Your Honor, this does not require relitigating the case. Mr. Gomez-Sanchez does not challenge that he was guilty of the crime. The crime required that he be found.
If the act constituting the crime is committed as a result of insanity, then he would be found not guilty by reason of insanity.
If it was found that he could not see the difference between right or wrong, then he'd be found not guilty by reason of insanity. He didn't raise that defense, and we're not raising it here. He may have known that swinging an instrument, which is all he was convicted of specifically intending to do, swing an instrument, was knowing a wrong, and an objectively reasonable person would have found that the significant risk of harm was likely to occur. Those are the requirements for 245A convictions.
You're not trying to vacate his conviction at this point?
No, Your Honor, not at all. We're simply trying to say that his mental state at the time of that.
But you could do that in any case, think of. You could just say, well, I was convicted of this crime, but I didn't have the requisite mental state. Even though I was found to have the requisite mental state in the conviction, I'm going to show that I really didn't.
Your Honor, but I didn't have the mental state to. I didn't have the intention, the subjective motivation to harm somebody. It's not the requisite mental state for the conviction, but the subjective intent to do harm to this person. And yes, all reliable evidence must be accepted by the immigration judge. Whether an immigration judge or a court is going to be convinced is a matter for those judges. I'm not asking this panel to pass on the ultimate issue. Only hold that the immigration judge and the board were required to consider all reliable evidence, including the subjective motivation of the person to do harm, to do violent harm.
So what is the difference between what the criminal court must have found in evidently concluding that his mental health didn't prevent him from forming the intent required for conviction and what you're arguing the board should have considered?
Certainly, Your Honor. So again, as I mentioned, the conviction does not require a specific intent. It's a general intent crime, not a specific intent to harm the victim. So the criminal court, by definition, did not find that Mr. Guillermo saw one way or the other that Mr. Guillermo Gomez-Sanchez intended to harm the individual that came across the street and talked to him that day. And what we would like to present to the immigration judge and have the judge consider is, for instance, evidence of his mental health, like at 426 of the record, that he suffered from, quote, delusional misidentification, the belief that an identity of a person's object or place has been altered. That's one of his symptoms. Mr. Gomez-Sanchez told the government psychiatrist that he thought he was wielding a stick, not a dumbbell. He told his mother the same thing, that's all on the record. If he thought, by reason of his mental health, that he was wielding a stick, that goes to the level of harm he can be implied to have intended to have committed. Yes, wielding a stick is dangerous as well, but not as dangerous as wielding a dumbbell. And immigration judges are required to consider all these factors in weighing whether our obligations under our refugee treaty must be met versus our obligations to protect.
So the idea is that people who commit exactly the same crime in exactly the same way would be treated differently for immigration purposes, depending on what they can prove was in their head.
Well, the immigration judge
is not a guy who does exactly the same thing as your client. He could be treated differently for everybody who commits aggravated felony, but then have the chance to prove, well, no, I didn't really mean it.
In fact, Your Honor, that's a specific rule of Blandino Medina in this court. This court specifically said that Congress's intent, it said one of Chevron, that Congress's intent was that all these cases be treated case by case, that no categorical presumptions can be permitted, and that was not Congress's intent.
So it sounded like part of your argument, though, was that this crime did not have a specific intent element. So are you saying that the BIA couldn't even have a rule that eliminated mental health evidence in specific intent crimes?
It's not an issue in this case, Your Honor, and I'm not prepared to go that far. Because categorical rules in general should be met with great skepticism in this statute, because of Congress's intent that they be met case by case. I can certainly imagine a situation where a domestic violence survivor commits a harmful battery upon her abuser, and for whatever reason she might deem fit, pleads guilty to it. Maybe she doesn't want to relive the incident for trial, whatever, and she doesn't want to challenge her specific intent to do harm. Should she be able to raise the fact that she has been diagnosed with battered women syndrome as a mitigating factor for determining whether the crime justifies the presumption that she's too dangerous to protect? And I would argue yes, but it's not before this court in this case, because I mean, it's not this person.
What's this case you're on?
So the matter of LS is Alfonso's fee holder. The resisting an executive officer.
You might have also mentioned Blandino just now. I think you were talking about the case by case where you.
So, yes, Your Honor, I apologize. So, Blandino Medina examined a case where the board said, just look at the elements of the crime and decide based on the elements of the crime if it's a particularly serious crime. And Blandino Medina looked at the statute. And a number of things determined that Congress's intent was that these cases be adjudicated case by case over three sort of different rationales under the statute. The withholding statute itself, that the implementation of our refugee treaties does not authorize, in its language, case by case, sort of by regulation, treatment of these cases. There is a similar provision in the asylum statute that said, and it reads the same way, a particularly serious crime is being treated such and such. It authorizes the Attorney General by regulation to determine cases to be particularly serious. And the court in Blandino Medina said, these laws were passed at the same time in the 1996 IRA amendments to the Act. Congress could have put the by regulation provision in the withholding version as well, but didn't. And that means they intended for these cases to be adjudicated case by case. It also looked at the fact that this was passed during IRA, a law that it acknowledged in a matter of LDS, the Court acknowledged this too, was a law that virtually across the board created strict rules for strict consequences for criminal acts in the immigration world, except for this one area, it lightened them. It restricted immigration judge discretion, except for in this one area, where it increased them. And it found that Congress's intent here was a very serious concern with our compliance with our refugee treaty, and giving judges the tools to strike that balance between the treaty obligations and our obligation to protect our community effectively. Your Honor, with the seeing I have 3 minutes remaining, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal unless you have other questions.
Okay, here we go.
Thank you.
Why,
what happened? Do you remember being interviewed by a policeman? Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Carmel Morgan on behalf of the respondent, the U.S. Attorney General. The government asks that you give Chevron deference to the board's published and reasonable determination that an alien's mental health as a factor in a criminal act comes within the purview of the criminal courts and should not be considered in determining whether the alien has committed a particularly serious crime for immigration purposes. In Blandino, the rule that the court established, it seems to be, is that you can't have a crime other than an aggravated felony with a 5-year sentence or more designated as a per se categorical particularly serious crime.
But in your view, that dealt with things outside the category of aggravated felonies, with crimes that don't fall within the definition of aggravated felonies. And using this Blandino-Medina, that's what it is.
Well, it's looking at a category of crimes. And here we're looking at limiting a type of evidence. I don't think they're the same thing. I don't think the statute disallows the Attorney General through the board to exercise its discretion to limit a particular type of evidence in these cases. It's not like a categorical bar specifically referencing a particular crime.
But how do you deal with Cone-New, or however that case is pronounced then?
In that case, they were looking at sentence enhancements and whether you could have a categorical rule that you cannot look at sentencing enhancements.
That's a type of evidence. Why doesn't that?
It is a type of evidence, but it's specifically enumerated in the Frontescue factors or the factors in matter of NAM, that you look at the type of sentence imposed. So it's quite obvious from the board's own precedent that a sentence enhancement would be a type of sentence imposed. You have to look at that in the case-by-case analysis.
The board said in the that we are considering adjudicators are constrained by how mental health issues were addressed as part of the criminal proceedings. How does that square with NAM that talks about including but not limited to the record of conviction and sentencing information? That was also language used in matter of LS, which suggests that it is
difference here, and what the board was trying to explain, they don't want to relitigate things that have already been decided by the criminal court.
So what was decided by the criminal court in this case?
That the alien
would be necessarily relitigated when the appellant says, we don't want a second bite at the apple, we're not contesting the validity of the conviction.
It is a bit confusing. Certainly you can relitigate criminal culpability. I'm not entirely sure, but it seems like the petitioner wants to address maybe moral culpability, but that's not relevant to a particularly serious crime analysis. What you can't do is to go back and negate, refute the mens rea element, which has already been decided by the criminal court.
What's the mens rea element of underlying crime?
It's a general intent, but in 245A1, assault with a deadly weapon, I think you have an intent to make an action that would likely result in serious harm to the victim. That type of intent has been found by the board in Matter of Wu, which I referred to in the 28J letter I supplied recently, to be morally turpitudinous. And it's been determined by this court to be a crime of violence as well. That's not the end of the matter, but it's certainly a good beginning.
Matter of Wu was about the question, maybe it's about a different question, right?
Yes.
It's about moral turpitude instead of particular serious crime.
Well, but the alien here, I think, is arguing that he wants to present mental health evidence to show that he didn't have an evil intent. And Matter of Wu is saying when you're talking about 245A1, which is his crime in this case, it necessarily involves an evil intent.
Well, for moral turpitude purposes, but for in LS, the board said that we look at intent when figuring out particularly serious crime. So it seems like there's tension at least between the two.
I think in LS, what the board was looking at, and what this court and the board has said multiple times, harm to a victim, harm to persons, makes it more likely that a crime is particularly serious. In Matter of LS, the crime was alien smuggling. The particular crime didn't address intent to harm. It didn't explicitly address that. It does in our case with assault with a deadly weapon. But in alien smuggling, you wouldn't be going against any finding of the criminal court by looking at that intent because it's not encapsulated in the crime itself.
But you're not going against any finding here either if it wasn't a specific element.
But the crime that we're talking about here does address, to some level, moral culpability or evil intent, as explained in Matter of Wu. Right. In the smuggling case, Matter of LS, the intent had to do with whether you knew the alien was not authorized to enter the United States. So it wasn't going potentially to refute an intent element decided by the criminal court as it does here.
Do you agree that it's required to do the case-by-case analysis? And that case-by-case analysis presumably includes an applicant's ability to present all reliable information. In that ballpark, doesn't that include, as I think your briefing suggested, evidence of mental state and intent, but you've precluded consideration of mental health in all cases? So I'm not clear what your position is on how you can have that categorical rule consistent with the mandate for a case-by-case analysis.
In this case, it's still a case-by-case analysis because the board went through the Franceschi factors, the nature of the crime, the facts and circumstances underlying the conviction and the type of sentence imposed. information. It's true that the board and this court have said you can look at all reliable evidence, and the government isn't contesting that he has a sad and long history of schizophrenia. That's true, and that's reliable, and he's got good medical documentation. The reason why you don't introduce it here are familiar principles. One has to do with collaterally attacking a criminal conviction in immigration court, which you cannot do. And another, in this case, is relevance. The fact that he was mentally ill doesn't lessen the danger that he poses to the community. And so for those two reasons, the board said we're not going to look at mental health evidence in this case.
Why can't it be something that's considered in case by case? And then, I mean, an IJ could say, I don't think this mental health evidence lessens the danger in this case, and so he's still dangerous, and it doesn't help you. But maybe there is a case in which mental health would affect dangerousness in some hypothetical. And it seems like our case-by-case analysis, our case-by-case requirement is really in tension with this blanket prohibition that the board has adopted.
I suppose the board could have come to a different conclusion, but the question for this court is whether you give the board Chevron deference and whether their decision is reasonable. And I think that it is. Courts have struggled with mental illness and evidence, and I think it's correct.
I mean, I think if we got to the statute's ambiguous, and so is it reasonable to have a rule that mental health doesn't affect dangerousness, that's a different question than whether the statute's ambiguous in the first place. And I'd like to return to your answer to my question about CONU, because I don't really understand. So you said that the difference is that in Frantescu, the one of the factors is to look at sentencing enhancements, but Frantescu also says that you have to look at the circumstances and underlying facts of the conviction. And I don't understand why someone's mental health isn't one of the circumstances or facts of the underlying event.
It seems to me to be more like personal circumstances of the offender, which the board has said you don't look at in a particularly serious crime analysis. It's really not like sentencing, where the mitigating factors go toward personal circumstances of the offender. The board has already said we're not looking at personal circumstances of the offender. We're not looking at family ties. We're not looking at the risk of persecution. We're looking at the crime and whether the crime is dangerous, not whether the criminal is dangerous, and not whether he poses a future danger. There's no separate test for future dangerousness. It's really confined to looking at the crime that was committed.
And you said earlier that the mental disability that doesn't lessen the danger to the community, given that there are all sorts of shades of mental disability, mental illness treatments, and consequences of symptoms. Why can that generality be applied simultaneously with a case-by-case analysis, allowing the applicant to present whatever it is that indicates that their mental state or condition presents a different kind or less than dangerousness to the community that would qualify them as particularly serious crime and thus disqualify them from non-removal?
The government's reading of this case, let's say that the crime here was the same, the alien smuggling crime. I think the board's decision might allow some evidence of his intent, as it did in matter of LS, to come in. What you can't do is to refute the mens rea decided by the criminal court. I'm not sure that it's a ban altogether on, I think it's medical documentation and reliance on generalizations about a mental disease.
But if someone had medical documentation that their mental disease prevented them from forming an intent, that would have to come in under LS, wouldn't it?
I think that would have to come in the criminal court context, and I think it's reasonable for the board to say we're not going to look at it because the alien had multiple opportunities to raise these issues.
You were coming down the path that if this crime was the same crime, again, as in LS.
Yes.
LS tells us you have the evidence of intent has to be allowed to come in, so if your mental health documentation from a doctor is you can't have an intent, how could that possibly not come in?
Well, I think in LS it was the intent to harm the victim. Here, the victim was hit in the head and got stitches.
Right. It should have failed. But in the hypothetical of LS, we're back at LS. LS, say the person in LS brought in medical documentation that they couldn't have intended to harm the person in the trunk. That comes in, doesn't it?
I think not. But I think you could have some evidence. If you look at Clark v. Arizona, the U.S. Supreme Court decision, they seem to talk about a difference between capacity versus observational evidence. I mean, here the witness who was the victim described that he didn't think the petitioner was all there. I don't think the board said you can't consider that.
But this is slightly different. I mean, let's say here he concedes, yes, I was dangerous, I guess I'd be dangerous, and I could see that statement. I've changed, I've not had medication, and so on. Why would this necessarily, assuming that it goes to the area of the crime, and it goes to something that was then gave up, could it be again? Okay.
Yeah.
What about saying, well, okay, that was then, this is now, I am now in the medical care, I'm taking.
That has no place under the board precedent about a particular serious crime analysis. It's well established that you're not looking at future dangerousness. The focus of a particularly serious crime analysis is on the dangerousness of the crime itself, and once that's been established, it's presumed that the alien is a danger to the community.
Irrebuttably presumed.
Hmm?
Irrebuttably presumed,
yes, yes. 8 CFR 1208.16D2 sets forth that once a particularly serious crime has been established, there's no separate determination about future dangerousness. You are irrebuttably presumed to be a danger to the community.
Maybe for that to make sense, you need to consider whether it really is a particularly serious crime in the way that it will last in terms of dangerousness. I mean, if you're going to treat every particularly serious crime as meaning that the person is dangerous forever, then maybe you need to look at the circumstances of the crime and see if that's true.
And the board did look at the circumstances of the crime. They considered the testimony of the victim. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors. If I may, I'd like to make two points, and if the time permitting, I might like to address the last point about future dangerousness. First, regarding the intent requirement, just to clarify, it is in a general intent crime such as this, in a matter of who did not change the interpretation of California criminal law, there is an intent to commit an act, in this case swinging an instrument, and then a finding that an objectively reasonable person would have understood that that act was significantly likely to result in harm, not an intent to do harm. And that intent to do harm has been found relevant in other cases. So to clarify that.
Why does that matter?
Well, it matters because
that an act that is likely to cause harm, why isn't that
because the old
people would say that's, yeah, that intent. But the kind of person that acts in ways that has the national consequences for other people, we don't want you in this country.
Yeah.
Well, why isn't that?
Because, Your Honor, in the en banc panel in LS articulated it well, and I'm just going to quote them. Quote, a determination that a crime is particularly serious cannot, therefore, be made in a vacuum. It must take into account that an alien convicted of such a crime and therefore excluded from such relief would be an alien who would otherwise meet the burden of proof for this relief, meaning he would otherwise meet the burden of proof that he's going to be persecuted. It's what the matter of LS is. There must be a balance struck between the dangerousness. It's not just dangerousness in a vacuum. This is so dangerous that we will not protect him. And that, and mental, and the board, and this board have repeatedly said that the person's subjective motivation is relevant to that analysis, because you have to look at all the circumstances. And the reason, to your point, Judge Freeland, that is important, is because that is the only way that this future harm, this failure to secure future harm, survives. This court on Bonk and Delgado, there's a footnote in there, I think in 17, that says, yes, we've said that. We said it in 1987 under a prior incarnation of the statute. And we've received a brief that says that's not the proper analysis from the United Nations, and we're not going to reach that issue. And you don't have to reach it here, but it does make sense that in order to properly read out this future dangerousness, you must look at all the circumstances of the crime. And that includes subjective intent and motivation when you're committed to it. And all it is that you're able to make a record so that the fact finders, Congress intended, the fact finder has all the factors in front of her and can weigh them and make the best judgment that she can.
And that's all you're seeking here, right? You just want to be able to present the evidence so that IJ could decide that this person is dangerous.
That's right. And if that happens, then the standard back before this panel would be an abuse of discretion standard in an entirely different kind of case.
The board is saying, no, if you acted with a crime with that kind of intent, you are presumably deemed to be a person that is dangerous.
That's right. The board is.
Why isn't that subject to Chevron deference? Why, I mean, the board interpret the statutes.
So, because under Blandino Medina, in step one of Chevron, the Ninth Circuit Court has found that the statute is unambiguous with regard to categorical treatment of these crimes.
Well, that was the situation where they were looking to add the category. The board tried to add to the category and was saying we can't do that. And the Congress decided what is a categorical exclusion. But this is we're here within the heartland of what Congress has excluded. Congress has said if it's an aggravated felony, you're not entitled to relief.
Except for
those who are the relief is not relevant.
Well, so you're entitled to relief. You're not entitled to relief except in withholding of removal, in which case you're not, as a matter of LSS, you're not even entitled to a presumption that you're ineligible. You get a case by case analysis. And even if you get to step two, a rule that singles out mental health and mental illness for a different kind of treatment, a different kind of evidentiary treatment, it has to be unreasonable. You couldn't have a rule, if this was a window filing of a visa application, you couldn't have a rule that says someone in a wheelchair can only submit evidence that fits in the window in your visa application. If you don't have a wheelchair, you can walk a bigger step around the building and submit it. Couldn't do that. Don't single it out mental health like that. It has to be unreasonable.
Am I right that part of your argument is that under Chevron 2, the agency has to be consistent and this interpretation is inconsistent with LS?
That's right. So LS, again, an en banc panel in NAM, which is a prior precedent, this decision did not overrule any of them. It said to them with a approval. And instead, tries to negotiate some way that they're all can be read together. This is not possible. NAM is very specific, saying we have historically accepted all evidence. We let both sides present evidence. That includes someone's lay testimony about, you know, which might be self-serving, but their own lay testimony.
That was the case involving the transportation of aliens.
That's right.
So this is not a case where the intent to harm was part of the crime.
Nor is this case, Your Honor. Intent to harm was not part of the crime. Intent to build an object.
Intent to do an act that actually results in harm.
That's right. But intent to slaughter someone across the
world. Oh, you think that a crime that has intent to harm is an element would be different?
I don't think, as I mentioned to Judge Freeland earlier, I don't think it's, I think, I would argue. argue the same, I would make the same argument that no categorical rules are permitted. It's not presented here. It's not the same argument. It's not as, if you will, clean as Mr. Gomez-Lachis' argument, because the court didn't consider that intent in this case. But I would argue that that goes against the rule against categorical treatment of these cases.
You're quibbling with me when you say, oh, this is not an intent to harm case, because you would argue the same thing in an intent to harm case. In fact, to be consistent, you would have to argue the same thing.
I don't mean
that. Even if an intent to harm was an element of crime, you would say, no, you're entitled to categorical, you're entitled to an individualized decision that you, in fact, are not in danger.
And I certainly don't intend to quibble. I'm solely on focusing what's at issue in this particular case. But I would be hesitant to agree with the sentence.
You can't possibly take a different position in a case like that. So the rule you're proposing, in fact, would cover that case. That's how we test the rules for us.
Yes.
So you say, well, you take it to the next case. So if you had a case where the statute, in fact, had intent to harm as an element, you would say, no, you're still entitled to it. Your argument necessarily requires an individualist determination there, too. There's no rational distinction between the two.
I wouldn't disagree with anything you said.
So in that case, you know, we can take this as an intent to harm case.
I can't concede that, but I do understand your point that you're seeking to establish a rule that and look at all the
options. It would sweep in an intent to harm case with an intent to harm as an element.
I don't believe you have to do that to overrule the board here, but if you take that as a message.
How would we do it without sweeping in that case?
Why couldn't we say, at least in a case where the holding wouldn't directly conflict with an element of the crime, it has to be case by case?
That's right. So for purposes of this case, you could leave aside for another day.
That wouldn't help you any, because in this case, it would defeat if you say, I don't have the mental state, then you would say, I don't really have the mental state to do an act that has results in harm. Because, you know, he thought it was a stick, he didn't think it was a barber.
So he didn't have the next step. So this isn't about mental state for the crime or for guilt. This, the equivalency between guilt and particularly serious crime analysis doesn't exist. He had the intent requisite for this crime to be guilty of it. Whether he has the requisite intent to be found particularly serious and therefore presumptively dangerous is a different question, and his subjective intent to actually harm somebody, which is a part of the criminal record here, is a necessary part of the criminal finding here, is relevant to that. And so you could resolve it on that limited issue. Although I would, as sort of a policy matter, I would be here arguing if there was a blanket rule on specific intent crimes. So for the domestic violence victim example, if I raise that.
I don't see how you're going to avoid it.
I'm sorry?
You don't see how you can avoid it in that case.
You're challenging the categorical rule that's been presented. And you're saying, in essence, no matter how it applies to Gomez-Sanchez, the fact of it is that if you keep a categorical rule in place like that, you can't be having a case-by-case analysis, no matter how those case-by-case analyses come out. Is that your position?
And yes, Your Honor, and that is consistent with this court's ruling in Arteaga, which is not a withholding case. It's a cancellation of removal case, one of these other areas where immigration judges have case-by-case discretion. And that's precisely the tension between the dissent and the majority in that opinion, actually, is whether one of these sort of these bright line rules, when you have case-by-case analysis, undercuts